for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is in Washington for talks with U.S. President Barack Obama. The U.S. president told reporters at a joint appearance with the German chancellor today that he hopes a diplomatic solution can be found for the crisis in Ukraine, where the government is battling pro-Russian separatists. He said his team is looking at all options against Russia if diplomacy fails, including the possibility of providing Ukraine with defensive lethal weapons. The European Union, meanwhile, decided to delay additional sanctions on Ukrainian separatists and Russians until after a four-nation summit takes place. Nigeria's Boko Haram militants launched new attacks in Niger and Cameroon on Monday as the group's leader vowed to defeat soldiers fighting the group. Witnesses say Boko Haram gunmen attacked a prison in the southeastern Niger town of Difa, but were driven back by Niger's army. This woman is a refugee from recent attacks by Boko Haram.
We are afraid of this Boko Haram because I saw many people who are killed by Boko Haram with my eyes before I come here. So that's why I am afraid. Maybe if I go to Nigeria now, maybe I will be killed. Because my father, they have killed my father. They have killed my brother. They have killed my net. So I am afraid to go to Nigeria again.
The Associated Press, meanwhile, says local residents in northern Cameroon are reporting suspected Boko Haram forces kidnapping more than a dozen people. Iraqi police say two bombings today killed at least 15 people. The incidents follow a series of blasts on Sunday that killed at least 37 people. This is VOA News. The AFP News Service reports top American military officials will today participate in a conference in Senegal along with the heads of 35 African armies. The conference has been called to discuss peace and security on the African continent. The Associated Press reports that former Grand Slam doubles champion Bob Hewitt has pleaded not guilty to charges of rape and assault on minors. The plea was made today in a Johannesburg court. The 75-year-old Australian is accused of raping two teenage girls in the early 1980s and another girl in 1994. Hewitt denies the charges. This from Reuters. Somalia's parliament has approved a new cabinet for the country. 25 cabinet members were approved. They comprise the second group nominated by Prime Minister Omar Abdelrashid Ali Shermark, the first group having been rejected. Nigeria's currency, the Naira, has fallen to its lowest value ever. The drop follows the announcement of a six-week delay in elections in Nigeria, which has stirred fears about political instability. UN-brokered talks aimed at resolving the political crisis in Yemen resumed today, but the discussions quickly broke up. Two political parties walked out of the talk saying they had been threatened by a representative of Houthi rebels. The negotiations were aimed at resolving the political crisis in the Arabian Peninsula state. Houthis captured the capital in September and took over the government last week. A large network of investigative journalists has found that the Swiss arm of Britain's largest bank helped clients avoid taxes and hide hundreds of millions of dollars in assets. Those clients of the Swiss subsidiary of the British-based HSBC include drug traffickers, arms dealers, and celebrities. The number two diplomats from the United States and South Korea held talks in Seoul today to discuss bilateral issues and North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Tony Blinken will spend 3 days in Seoul. He's on the first leg of an Asian trip that will also take him to China and Japan. A drone strike killed an influential Afghan militant in Helmand province today. The Helmand police chief says Mullah Abdul Rauf, a former Guantanamo Bay detainee, and five others were killed while traveling in a car. He did not provide details. The United States Supreme Court says it will not stop same-sex marriages from taking place in the state of Alabama. The court today denied a request by Alabama's attorney general to continue a hold on a federal judge's ruling overturning the state's ban on gay marriage. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The decision to postpone Nigeria's election by 6 weeks has met with criticism at home and abroad. Voters in Nigeria say they are disappointed.
That's VOA's Ann Look reporting from Abuja. Details coming up.
Also, the Somali parliament approves a new presidential cabinet today, moments after one lawmaker was shot and killed in Mogadishu.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Somali parliament approved a new presidential cabinet today, moments after one lawmaker was shot and killed in Mogadishu as he left his home to vote. A spokesman for Al-Shabaab told the French news agency the militant group was responsible for the killing. Abdullah Keita Barre was the first lawmaker to be assassinated this year. Four were killed last year. The lawmakers voted overwhelmingly to endorse Prime Minister Omar Abdelrashid Ali Shamarke's cabinet of 26 ministers and 40 deputy ministers. Shamarke took office in December. Parliament rejected his first list of cabinet appointments. Despite the continuing threat of Al-Shabaab violence, Somalia is expected to vote on a new constitution soon and to hold national elections in 2016.
Boko Haram fighters returned to the Niger border town of Difa today in a third attempt to occupy it. Niger military sources say they were successful in turning back the rebel force. No casualties have yet been reported. Difa is close to the border of northern Nigeria, where Boko Haram has waged a five-year insurrection. It's blamed for killing more than 10,000 people and displacing more than a million in three northern states. In the Niger capital, Niamey, Parliament is expected to authorize its own force to cross into Nigeria and join Chad, Cameroon, and Nigeria to fight Boko Haram. This week, the African Union is requesting UN Security Council endorsement of an 8,700-troop regional force to confront Boko Haram. U.S. officials estimate Boko Haram has up to 8,000 well-armed fighters. In a video released on YouTube today, the leader of Boko Haram dismisses the threat of a proposed regional military force. In a video released later, Abubakar Shekau boasts, "We never rose up to fight Africa. We rose up to fight the world."
And the decision to postpone Nigeria's elections by 6 weeks has met with criticism at home and abroad. Voters in Nigeria say they are disappointed. VOA's Ann Look has the story from Abuja.
Nigeria's Electoral Commission says it pushed back the February 14th and February 28th polls because security agencies say they cannot secure voting and need more time to fight Boko Haram in the northeast. That claim has been met with a fair bit of skepticism from voters.
6 weeks to end insurgency when they have taken a whole 5 years, they have not been able to deal with it. It will not change anything, and they are just postponing the inevitable.
Boko Haram militants control large swaths of territory and are threatening the Borno state capital, Maiduguri. Regional troops began deploying last month as the conflict spilled over the borders. But many voters think this delay is about politics, not security. Recent polls show the ruling PDP party neck and neck with main opposition party, the APC. It's the PDP's first major challenge since coming to power in 1999.
And we know APC wants the election to hold. PDP is buying time. I feel our leaders are playing politics with the system, which is so unfortunate. But we get it right at the end of the day.
Three court cases have been filed to try to disqualify APC presidential candidate Muhammadu Buhari. Buhari has called for calm. His supporters say they are confident.
No matter how the election is being postponed, we're still going to come out and vote for our right because we are sick and tired of this government. All we need is change.
The government denies the delay is politically motivated and says the security and logistical challenges are real. About 35% of voters still need to pick up their voter cards, for example. Some voters say the six-week postponement is okay if it means more people get to vote and that candidates are less likely to contest results.
We are not looking at the 6 week alone, but we were looking at the perfection of the election, which is more important.
The Electoral Commission insisted that it was ready to hold credible polls on February 14th, but says it will make good use of the extra time. Ann Look, VOA News, Abuja.
More than 20 football fans died and 25 others were injured in a stampede at the Cairo stadium yesterday. The Interior Ministry says Egyptian forces fired tear gas into crowds trying to force their way into the stadium. Government sources say the dead were crushed when the crowd panicked. Officials said some died of broken necks. Many social media accounts claim police fired birdshot into the crowd. Prime Minister Ibrahim Matab has suspended all major football matches. The stadium deaths are seen by some as a setback for the law and order regime of President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. The match at the Air Defense Stadium in suburban Cairo was between two Cairo clubs, Zamalek and NAP. The owner of Zamalek denied police-fired birdshot. Mortrad Mansour, who is a supporter of President Sisi, charged that the stadium violence was orchestrated by thugs to derail parliamentary elections that begin in March. During 4 years of social unrest, security forces have limited attendance at football matches. Only 10,000 were being admitted to yesterday's match. Others who tried to enter the stadium reportedly had no tickets. 3 years ago, 74 fans died in a clash with police at a Port Said stadium.
International donors at a conference in Nairobi have pledged an additional $529 million toward humanitarian relief in South Sudan. But as VOA's Gabe Joslow reports, despite the outpouring of goodwill at the conference, there was an undercurrent of frustration with the country's leadership for prolonging the civil conflict.
UN Humanitarian Chief Valerie Amos told reporters Monday that pledges made at the conference bring the amount raised for South Sudan this year to $618 million. The sum is barely one-third of the $1.8 billion the UN has requested. Amos, who had just returned from a trip to South Sudan, called on the country's leaders to work toward peace.
The leaders of South Sudan, the government and the opposition, need to think about their people. And I have to say that we felt very strongly yesterday that if they actually went out and saw the conditions in which their people are living, it might actually mean that they would pause and think again about the importance of peace.
The conflict in South Sudan began in December 2013 when a political dispute between the president and his deputy turned violent, splitting the ruling party and the military into rival factions. Agencies warn that 2.5 million people are already hungry in the country and that the numbers could rise without emergency assistance. American actor Forrest Whitaker, a UN special envoy for peace and reconciliation who accompanied Amos in South Sudan, also spoke of the need to support the people of the country above all else.
And I become more convinced every time I'm in South Sudan of the will and the resilience of the people. If the political and military leaders respect that will, if they can protect, nurture the people in their own country, then there's a future.
Addressing the conference, South Sudanese Foreign Minister Barnaba Mario Benjamin thanked the international community for their support and urged patience with the peace process, promising his government is committed to reconciliation.
We are all gathered here, including the international partners of goodwill, to bring about sanity and end the sudden loss of lives and immense suffering of innocent women and children. These are our mothers and sisters, and we want an end to it.
The United States pledged nearly $273 million in new humanitarian assistance to South Sudan. Speaking to VOA on the sidelines of the conference, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Ann Richard emphasized that the U.S. remains concerned about the pace of peace negotiations.
We did express our frustration and our concerns about the lack of a peace agreement. We directed our concerns at both the government of South Sudan and other parties to the conflict.
South Sudan's warring factions have signed multiple ceasefire deals since January of last year and have been engaged in more comprehensive peace negotiations mediated by the East African Group of Nations, IGAD. So far, none of the ceasefire deals have lasted and low-level fighting continues. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
A new study finds millions of girls in at least 70 countries are subjected to widespread attacks that are occurring with increasing regularity to prevent them from receiving an education. The report by the United Nations Human Rights Office finds schools and infrastructure in 24 of these countries are also used for military purposes. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
While celebrating the achievements of the past two decades in ensuring that millions of girls around the world have access to education, the study also highlights the current grim state of girls' education. UN statistics show about 65 million children do not attend school, particularly in countries of sub-Saharan Africa, Oceania, and West Asia. The report documents many cases between 2009 and 2014 of physical attacks against girls, parents, and teachers advocating for gender equality in education. Some of the attacks cited have made headlines and shocked people by their cruelty. These include the killing in December 2014 of more than 100 children by the Taliban at an army school in Pakistan, the abduction of nearly 300 schoolgirls by Boko Haram in Nigeria in April 2014, and the 2012 shooting of the young Nobel Peace Laureate Malala Yousafzai by members of the Taliban in Pakistan. The chief of the Women's Human Rights and Gender section at the UN Human Rights Office, Veronica Birga, says many other alarming attacks against girls never make the headlines. For instance, she cites cases of acid attacks and poisoning by the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan.
A number of girls were abducted from a Christian school in India and raped in 2013. In Somalia, girls have been forcibly removed from school to become so-called wives of Al-Shabaab fighters. And in countries such as Mali, Sudan, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, very strict dress codes have been imposed through the use of violence, including sexual violence, on schoolgirls.
The report notes attacks on girls do not take place only in countries in conflict. They also occur in situations of high criminality or political instability, which is the case in a number of countries of Central America. It says girls are attacked by those who are opposed to their education as a means of social change. They believe education is wasted on girls whose role is to remain at home. It says the common cause of all these attacks is discrimination. Birga says girls who are prevented from going to school are extremely vulnerable to exploitation and abuse.
And since they're more exposed to child and forced marriages, they're more exposed to trafficking, they're more exposed to worst forms of child labor. And more in general, a girl that's not educated will face, consequences throughout her life. A girl or a woman who's not educated is less likely to be aware of her rights and less likely to be able to claim them.
The report urges governments to make the perpetrators of attacks against schoolgirls, their parents, and teachers accountable for their actions. It says the message that violence against girls is acceptable is reinforced when attacks are met with impunity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new report launched by the Enough Project and its partner, the Satellite Sentinel Project, reveals how smart technology can stop armed groups from slaughtering elephants for ivory in the DRC. New satellite imaging and geospatial mapping have identified that ivory trafficking in the Garamba National Park is funding armed groups that are responsible for widespread atrocities. The imaging also identifies how armed groups are using sophisticated techniques to evade detection of their poaching and trafficking activities. Such forces include the Lord's Resistance Army, renegade elements of the Congolese National Army, and other armed groups from South Sudan and Sudan. Sasha Lesneff is Associate Director of Policy at the Enough Project. He spoke with me about how the new technology will help park rangers halt the slaughter of elephants.
Well, our imagery shows that there has been a dramatic rise in poaching in Garamba National Park over the last 9 years. And what our imagery shows is pinpointing some of the locations of where the elephant poaching is occurring in order to provide some attempted predictive analytics for the actual park rangers who are trying to track poachers down and track the elephants. So in particular, 50% of the poaching elephants that took place in 2013 were within 5 kilometers of a 2012 event. We also further reduced probable poaching to areas in the future of less than 32 kilometers, which is a 98% reduction in the overall park area. So we've partnered with the park rangers, African Parks, to help them try to track where such poaching might occur so that they can deploy their new helicopter and any other tools available to combat those efforts, which are increasingly high-tech.
Will this new technology be able to actually show what is happening at that real time, for instance, the actual slaughtering of the elephants, so that it can be addressed at that time that it is happening?
Well, the data that Digital Globe provided is more data on where the elephants were killed. It's not real-time information, but it gives some analysis as to where the poaching has taken place, where the elephant movements are, at least those elephants that are tracked, which is a fairly low number and mostly focused on the southern part of the park. But it does offer a window into where possible poaching may occur.
Your report also showed that militant groups such as the LRA and others, it also shows that they too have technology that could possibly tell when someone is looking at them.
Indeed, this research and a couple of other studies that we have put out after traveling to Garamba and talking to ex-combatants who were stationed in that area shows that the LRA's new lifeline is the ivory trade. Joseph Kony, the LRA's leader, has ordered different combatants to save elephant tusks after they kill the elephants. A lot of the combatants don't know where this goes and what it's used for, but according to our information, a lot of the ivory is actually trafficked through Sudanese-held territory. There are other poachers as well that use helicopters. The Congolese army has both been involved in combating poaching as well as being involved in poaching, and there are South Sudanese poachers as well. You know, the park rangers are at a technological disadvantage. Warren Buffett's son, Howard Buffett, his foundation, providing the Garamba park rangers with one helicopter, so that should help. That was just announced 2 weeks ago. But really, the United Nations needs to do more on this, particularly to increase defection efforts from the LRA. And the U.S. should provide increased assistance to the park rangers on the ground. The elephants may disappear from Garamba altogether, so we want to prevent that from happening.
Overall, how effective do you think helicopters will be in combating trafficking?
The helicopter support was just announced 2 weeks ago, so it's too early to tell as for how effective they would be. But we do know that in a relatively recent development, the poachers themselves are shooting down some elephants from helicopters. The LRA is more likely using more rudimentary means on land, but there are other more sophisticated poachers that use the helicopters. So, you know, the only choice is really for the park rangers themselves to use satellite data, to use predictive analytics, to use helicopters and other technology to be able to track those poachers. That said, Garamba National Park is just under 5,000 square kilometers. So it's a huge area, and they really mainly operate only in the southern part of the park. So there is quite a bit left to be done.
That was Sasha Lesneff, Associate Director of Policy at the Enough Project. He spoke with me from Washington.
The aid organization Concern Worldwide says rising food prices and lack of employment in Kenya's slum areas have pushed an already desperate people into extreme poverty. The organization blames the Kenyan government for ignoring the plight of hundreds of thousands of slum residents in Nairobi. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Kenya's 2009 census shows more than 3 million people leaving the capital, Nairobi. And of that number, two-thirds reside in slum areas where unemployment is high. People struggle to feed their families and lack basics like running water, electricity and proper drainage systems. Concern Worldwide's country director, Wendy Erasmus, says Kenya's standard for defining an emergency fits rural areas but not urban ones.
So in Kenya we use a number of indicators that were mainly developed around a rural context. So they look at things like crude mortality, acute malnutrition, dietary diversity, and coping strategies. Here in the urban setting, what we find is not only are the indicators slightly different, but the thresholds that require a response are also likely to be very different.
Over the years, the Kenyan government, with the help of humanitarian agencies, has scaled up its operation in providing food, water and medical aid to the people of rural areas, especially the drought-stricken north. According to Concern Worldwide, people living in slum areas are not getting attention and help like residents of other areas. The organization blames the policies of the government. Erasmus says with more people immigrating to Nairobi in search of better job opportunities, more attention has to be paid to such individuals.
We need to realize that in the future, most people are living in an urban context, and that's where the emergencies are going to have the biggest impact. We also need to recognize that urban emergencies are different, and because they're different, we need to institute a crisis management and contingency fund for the urban context.
Concern Worldwide says some families in slum areas resort to what it calls negative coping strategies for short-term survival. Those strategies include relying on loans for basic commodities, withdrawing children from school, transactional sex by women and their older female children, and both petty and serious crimes. In January, President Uhuru Kenyatta launched three projects to upgrade slums. The government employed more than 3,000 youths to participate in cleanup programs and road construction. Mr. Kenyatta said it was unfortunate that in the past, development and government projects favoured other areas. Reverend Gideon Nzioki in Korogocho slum, one of the areas getting a facelift, knows the changes that are taking place, but says that many residents are still going hungry.
The government need to intervene to these emergencies, because if somebody, people, they have no food, the government need to come up. Like now, this time, the inflation is too high and they cannot afford. The government need to come in and support the community.
The Kenyatta government insists it's willing and ready to improve the lives of people living in urban settings, but it will need more time to reach and cater for the needs of such people after decades of neglect by previous administrations. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's up, Africa? It's Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
Can I be upfront with you? That's exactly what Nadia and I plan to do every Wednesday at 1730 UTC. Upfront looks at issues that affect you.
Since the world is moving at a faster rate, they need to have a major computer.
Interesting news.
Canadian man was sentenced for drunk driving after being pulled over in his mother's motorized wheelchair. 35-year-old man was fined and placed on probation.
And of course, music.
No clouds in my stones.
Entertainment, celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it.
And of course, we love to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments. Our email address is upfront@voanews.com.
So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 17:30 UTC on The Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The Somali parliament approves a new presidential cabinet today, moments after one lawmaker was shot and killed in Mogadishu. The decision to postpone Nigeria's elections by 6 weeks has met with criticism at home and abroad. And more than 20 football fans died and 25 others were injured in a stampede at a Cairo stadium yesterday. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa and in our feature segment, recognizing the history and achievements of African Americans. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. And happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have some kudos for Ivory Coast football.
Kim, here's a sunny side of sports salute to the elephants of Ivory Coast, who lifted their second Africa Cup of Nations football trophy and first since 1992 with a dramatic 9-8 penalty kick victory over Ghana in Bata, Equatorial Guinea. There was definitely some deja vu in Bata. The same teams played for the Nations Cup trophy in 1992 when Ivory Coast, yes, prevailed in another marathon penalty kick shootout, 11-10. The hero for Ivory Coast in the Bata shootout was goalkeeper Boubacar Barry, who converted the winning spot kick after making some crucial stops in front of the net. The shootout came after 120 minutes of scoreless football from the teams in a match of few scoring opportunities. The French coach for Ivory Coast, Hervé Renard, says the five previous matches in the tournament played by both squads may have taken a toll on both teams.
The game was very tough. I think two teams were a bit tired after five games and nobody wanted to attack. It's coming from God, it's coming from the luck. But you have also to be strong. I tried to tell them, even on penalty, it will be okay for us. It will be our time because it's the same like in 1992. I believe on the history and I'm a low-key coach.
Hervé Renard says he's a low-key coach. He danced shirtless with his players after the match. Renard is also a confident coach. During the tense penalty kick shootout, he could be seen on the sidelines smiling at the television cameras. And Renard is also a successful coach. He took charge of Ivory Coast after leading Zambia to the Nations Cup trophy in 2012. Meanwhile, his coaching counterpart for Ghana, Israeli tactician Avram Grant, says the Black Stars of Ghana were the better team in the Nations Cup final.
Even in this game, against a team that have so many good players, we was the better side. They didn't create even one chance in 120 minutes. And all of this tournament, we scored a lot of goals. I think we scored the highest more than any team. We conceded less than any team. We did a lot of good things. And I think even we thought about the future that I think everybody in Ghana can be proud in this team. They show a lot of good things.
Coach Avram Grant and the Black Stars of Ghana were hoping to win their first Nations Cup championship in 33 years. But alas, it was not to be after the heartbreaking loss in the shootout. Star striker Asamoah John says the Black Stars are disappointed but also hopeful about the future.
We have no excuses now. We went to the penalty shootout, and then we lost today. I think they've gone to the final on two occasions, and then they've lost. And then this year they came back again to win it. You know, they went to penalty shootout, you know, for two times. And then this is the third time they went to penalty shootout in the final, and then they won. You know, so I'm very, very sad at the moment. Everybody's sad. But I don't regret our performance at all. I think we did so well in the competition. And then we are hoping, I think we've got a bright future because we've got young quality players.
This 2015 Nations Cup proved to be very challenging on the health front for Asamoah John. He missed Ghana's opening match because of malaria. And John also sat out Ghana's 3-0 victory over Equatorial Guinea in the semifinals after a player from Guinea stomped on his stomach during the quarterfinals. In more Nations Cup news, a few of Asamoah John's Ghana teammates won awards for their performances, as we hear now from our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Auma.
Midfielder Christian Atsu got two awards, the Orange Man of the competition and the Nissan Goal of the tournament against Guinea. Andre Ayew was named Pepsi highest scorer, while Kwesi Appiah got the Samsung Fair Player of the tournament. The Democratic Republic of Congo won the Fair Play Prize. Earlier, the Democratic Republic of Congo edged Equatorial Guinea 4-2 in a post-match penalty shootout in the bronze medal playoff in Malabo on Saturday. Penalty kicks followed as the teams were deadlocked at 0-0 in open play.
February is Black History Month here in the United States. And just ahead, my VOA colleague James Buddy will have a Black History Month segment dealing with an Olympic figure skater and a former boxing champion.
Yesterday, Sunday, 1986, figure skater Debbie Thomas became the first African-American to win the women's single of the U.S. National Figure Skating Championship competition. Also yesterday, Sunday, in 1978, Leon Spinks defeated world heavyweight boxing champion Muhammad Ali. Ali regained the title on September 15 that same year and went on to become the first person to win the heavyweight boxing title three times.
He talks a great deal and brags indeedy of a muscular punch that's incredibly speedy. The fistic world was dull and weary. With a champ like Liston, things had to be dreary. Then someone with color, someone with dash, brought fight fans a-running with cash.
Show me the money.
This brash young boxer is something to see, and the heavyweight championship is his destiny. This kid fights great. He's got speed and endurance. But if you sign to fight him, increase your insurance. I am the greatest.
Voice of America.
With the 30th Nations Cup tournament now history, the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Segun Dot on the Spot Adeyemi, takes a look back at African football's premier event.
Good evening, Africa. The Central African nation of Equatorial Guinea hosted the tournament after original host Morocco backed out over Ebola fears. The tournament, the 30th edition, featured 16 teams in the finals. The finalists are host Equatorial Guinea, Congo, Gabon, Burkina Faso, Tunisia, Democratic Republic of Congo, or DR Congo, Cape Verde, Zambia, Ghana, Algeria, Senegal, South Africa, Ivory Coast, Guinea, Mali, and Cameroon. In the round robin first round, Mali, Cameroon, Senegal, South Africa, Cape Verde, Zambia, Burkina Faso, and Gabon were eliminated. Another 8 teams, Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Tunisia, DR Congo, Ghana, Algeria, Ivory Coast, and Guinea advanced to the quarterfinals. Then DR Congo, Ivory Coast, Ghana, and Equatorial Guinea reached the last four. Equatorial Guinea ended the tournament on a low note as it lost the third place match 4-2 on penalties after playing goalless with DR Congo on Saturday. Javier Balboa and Raul Fabiani both missed their penalty kicks, while all four DR Congo penalty takers found the net, with Cedric Mogongo firing home the decisive kick. Although supporters likely stayed away from the playoff, after the fan violence that marked Equatorial Guinea's semi-final defeat to Ghana on Thursday, those in attendance created a fitting atmosphere for the host final match. The two defeated semi-finalists played out a low-key but well-tempered goalless draw and had to be separated by the first penalty shootout of the 2015 tournament. One sad aspect of the 2015 tournament is crowd violence. The semi-final clash between the hosts and Ghana witnessed violent scenes in Malabo on Thursday that saw at least 36 people injured, one seriously. The game, which Ghana won 3-0, was stopped for more than 30 minutes near the end as objects were thrown from the stands at the opposing team, officials and fans by locals who were angry at the demise of their team. That violence prompted organizers to take extra security measures for Sunday's final. Media director of the Confederation of African Football, CAF, Junior Binyam, said the organizers asked for extra police and security to be put in place ahead of the final.
Hi, this is VOA's Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. You're listening to my friend Segun Dot on the spot at the Amy.
Meanwhile, CAF has fined Equatorial Guinea for the crowd violence. The hosts were fined $100,000 on Friday for the behavior of their supporters during the semi-final loss to Ghana. Though part of their sanction is that they must play their next game behind closed doors, that part was suspended. Hence, they had spectators at their third-place match on Saturday. Equatorial Guinea was also fined $5,000 on Monday for an invasion of the pitch by a few spectators after the country's upset win over Tunisia in the quarterfinal in Bata. Talking about sanctions, Morocco has been banned from the next two African Nations Cup tournaments as punishment for withdrawing from hosting the 2015 finals over Ebola fears. That means the Moroccans will miss the 2017 and 2019 Africa Cup of Nations tournaments. The Royal Moroccan Football Federation, FRMF, has also been fined $1 million and ordered to pay $9.12 million in damages to CAF and their partners, CAF said in a statement. Morocco had requested for the continental tournament to be postponed by a year to allow the Ebola outbreak in West Africa to be contained. The North African country was stripped of its hosting right by CAF in November last year, with the tournament switched to Equatorial Guinea, which stepped in at the last minute.
Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks, Segun. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, recognizing the history and achievements of African Americans. And next, we focus on Kenya's advanced tech industry. But first, some music. Here is South Africa's Yvonne Chaka Chaka with The Power of Africa.
Oh, yeah.
South Africa's Yvonne Shaka Chaka with the power of Africa.
Well, February is Black History Month, a time to recognize the history and achievements of African Americans. Just south of the nation's capital in Alexandria, Virginia, are the remains of an old pen where slaves were kept. The site contains a single building, now home to a civil rights organization, and a small museum about slavery. The pen played a role in the award-winning movie 12 Years a Slave. It's based on the memoir of Solomon Northrup, a free black man who was kidnapped in Washington in 1841. The slave trader who owned the pen sold Northrup and other men, women, and children as property. VOA's Deborah Block takes us there.
Thousands of slaves passed through the doors of this house in Alexandria, Virginia, and the Freedom House Museum downstairs provides a glimpse about what they experienced. As many as 60 men at a time were held in this small space, separated from their families. Ugandan-born curator Julian Kaganda cannot imagine what it was like for them to know they might never see their loved ones again.
Seeing that African Americans had experienced on a regular basis the separation of family, that for me was just so heartbreaking.
Most of the slaves had worked on local plantations picking tobacco. When the soil was exhausted, they were sold to plantations further south to pick cotton, says Audrey Davis, head of Alexandria's Black History Museum.
They were coming from a variety of places and then being held in the slave pens until they were shipped out or until someone was buying them directly from the pen, and then they would be brought out for inspection.
The slave pen took up an entire block and was one of the most lucrative in the country. There was a kitchen, infirmary, dining area, and an outdoor courtyard for exercise. The traders knew that healthier-looking slaves would command higher prices and even gave them new clothes.
The tailor shop would create the clothes that the slaves would wear at the market so that they looked expensive. The slaves, they would actually try to get rid of these clothes as soon as they could because they did not want to be reminded of being sold at market like property.
The slaves were sold for up to four times what the traders had paid for them.
People would pay $1,200 for a slave back in those days, which is the equivalent of almost $30,000 in today's money.
This metal door in the museum is a copy, but the bars on the windows and the brick walls are original. Jacqueline Nordorf, visiting from California, said it is chilling to imagine slaves crowded against these walls.
It saddens me, but it is our history. It was scary to be in a place where the slaves were actually kept and these people were sold for their lives.
When they were transported, the slaves were shackled together to prevent escape and put on ships or forced to walk long distances to plantations in the South. Visitors are encouraged to touch these slave chains.
We felt it was important for people to have, you know, the ability to actually feel these things and feel the reality of what happened here.
Some people feel the presence of spirits here. The house now belongs to the Northern Virginia chapter of the Urban League, an organization that empowers African Americans. Chief Executive Officer Cynthia Dinkins and her staff say they have heard and seen things they can't explain.
I felt something brush against me, but I didn't feel threatened at all. And they're like, oh no, yes, yes, we've experienced things like that, doors opening and closing, footsteps.
The slave pen was closed during the American Civil War, fought between the Northern Union and Southern Confederacy, where slavery supported the economy. After Southern-backed Alexandria surrendered to Union soldiers in 1861, the pen was turned into a prison. It was used to jail unruly Union soldiers, and ironically, Confederate soldiers, who found themselves captured and held as the slaves had been. Deborah Block, VOA News, Alexandria.
Kenya's tech scene is one of Africa's most advanced, with soaring phone use and cheap data spiraling growth. But tech entrepreneurs say investment capital is scarce, and investors drawn to Africa's Silicon Savannah say there is a shortage of innovation to meet needs.
We live in a push-button world, more and more that applies to how we learn, too. An app called Eneza is helping these children in Nairobi. In Swahili, the word means spread.
We normally pick on a subject. After that, we pick on the challenging questions, then we work them on the board together with the pupils.
The app helps teachers like Julian Ocheng give many pupils, especially the poorer ones, something they might only hope for, free, unlimited access to learning materials. All you do is dial a simple chord.
Direct you and tell you the right answer and tell you more about the question.
Like the app's users, Kenya's tech startup scene is youthful, eager, but lacking resources. Eneza is an exception. It got funded by Kenya's biggest mobile operator, Safaricom, and others. Money they couldn't do without, says Eneza developer Christopher Asego.
When you're starting a business, you want it to, like, sort of fund itself. So, I mean, the initial funding that we got brought us this far. We have close to 350,000 students on the platform.
Safaricom itself is proof that innovation can work. It's a pioneer of M-Pesa mobile money transfer technology, now used across Africa, Asia, and Europe, and generated $300 million in the last financial year. But success is elusive for would-be entrepreneurs. Even as they brainstorm in a local tech hub, a new report says many startups simply don't start. Over two-thirds of them not earning enough to keep a small team going. iHub administrator Mogethi Kitau.
It comes from, first of all, maybe identifying the right gap into the market and creating the right solution to address that gap, to getting the necessary support.
A lack of investment and right ideas to monetize may be the two big problems, but investors should look through them, says Mugethi.
Invest your money, invest your mentorship, and I would like to encourage young people to keep innovating.
After all, says its fans, with mobile phone use at nearly 80% in Kenya, cheap data and soaring smartphone uptake, Kenya has all the right buttons to push.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yais Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Greg Burns, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The nature of the terrorist threat has evolved over the course of the past several years. While the threat posed by al-Qaeda with its centralized hierarchical terrorist command structure has now diminished, largely as a result of leadership losses suffered by the AQ Corps, other violent extremist groups have emerged. Groups that have become active in places like Yemen, Syria, Libya, Iraq, and Somalia are mainly localized, but some pose a threat to Western interests in Europe and the United States, and we take these security concerns very seriously. Lately, the most visible manifestation of terrorism in the West has come in the context of so-called lone wolf offender attacks, as we saw in the case of the terrorist assassinations at the Paris publication Charlie Hebdo. Only by working together can the international community successfully counter groups like these, said Tina Cadenow, U.S. Ambassador at Large and Coordinator for Counterterrorism. Take ISIL, for example. We have worked to build an effective anti-ISIL coalition, a coalition that is clearly crucial because the fight against ISIL is not one the U.S. can or should pursue alone. More than 60 partners are contributing to this effort, which is multifaceted in its goals, not only to stop ISIL's advance on the ground, but to combat the flow of foreign fighters, disrupt ISIL's financial resources, and counteract ISIL's messaging and undermine its appeal, said Ambassador Cadenow. The United States believes a successful approach to counterterrorism must revolve around partnerships. Effective partnering means identifying governmental, non-governmental, and multilateral actors overseas that can make a difference in this battle against the most salient terrorist threats facing the international community. Partners come with various capabilities and varying amounts of political will. So cultivating them is not just a matter of diplomatic engagement, but also means working with them to develop the technical and practical skills needed to counter terrorism within their borders and beyond. The threats we confront are serious and far-reaching, and it will take considerable time and effort to develop the partnerships and institutional components we need to address them, said Ambassador Cadenow. Nevertheless, we believe this is the most effective and sustainable approach to a complex and enduring challenge.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Let's talk. Join host Sande Shumari and his guests discussing love between the young and old couple. This light-hearted show discusses topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on